This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's not just baseball. Performing-enhancing drugs have been a problem in thoroughbred horse racing for decades, a problem that many believe has now reached a crisis. A study last year at California's Del Mar Racetrack found that 10 horses out of 100 tested positive for milkshakes. That's sodium bicarbonate, baking soda, that trainers pump into a horse's stomach on race day. The concoction counteracts lactic acid that's produced by strenuous exercise and the fatigue it causes. Horses can run longer and faster, and the best part for the trainers is that the milkshake is virtually undetectable after a race, which is when horses are tested. That's on top of the dozens of painkillers, diuretics, anti-bleeding medicines, and hormones. Some of them are legal, some are legal sometimes, some are legal in some states but not in others, and some are cheating, plain and simple. Horse players, a suspicious lot by nature, are increasingly convinced that the game is fixed, a view reinforced when a prominent trainer in California told the Los Angeles Times that, quote, "There are a lot of things that people don't know and won't know. If you bet on horses, I would call you an idiot." Later in the program, the most controversial politician in the Netherlands, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, is a feminist, activist, atheist, and terrorist target. But first, 2 days before the Kentucky Derby, drugs and horse racing. If you have questions about this problem, about what's being done to address it, we'd like to hear from you. If you're a bettor or a casual fan, a vet or a breeder, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. We begin in California, where an effort is underway to clean up the problem. Joining us now on the phone from Sierra Madre is Dr. Rick Arthur, a practicing veterinarian, director of the Oak Tree Racing Association. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
The Oak Tree Racing Association partly funded the survey at Del Mar that found 10% of the horses tested positive for milkshakes. Did that number surprise you?
Yes, it really did. We actually funded a preliminary study through the Horse Racing Board, and when we had difficulty getting the results from the previous administration, we encouraged Del Mar to undertake the program directly without the Horse Racing Board being involved. And we'd previously been told that there wasn't a problem from several hundred tests that had been taken earlier in the year that Oak Tree and Bill Bianco, who owns one of the horses in the Kentucky Derby and a commissioner of Horse Racing Board, paid for. And when we got the results from the first eight races, I have to say we were shocked. And to correct you somewhat, there were 10% of the horses tested over 39 millimoles of total carbon dioxide, which is very high, and over 20% tested over 37 millimoles is what we define as the threshold level subsequently in California. Horses that test over 37 millimoles have been administered an alkalizing agent.
So this is even worse.
Yes, it is. It was worse. What we started at Oak Tree is we tested every horse that ran. And whereas at Del Mar we had 10% that were over 39, we had one horse out of 1,773 horses test over 39 at Oak Tree, and eight, including the one I just mentioned, test over 37 millimoles out of the same number, which is going from basically over 20% to 0.4%. At that time, we were treating it as an intervention. We'd bring the trainers in. We would, bring them into the principal, tell them not to do it again. We'd put added surveillance on their barn. But we had a couple of people come back again. At Santa Anita, what we started doing is we actually, under a contract between the trainers' organization, the owners' organization, and Santa Anita, we started placing those people in the detention barn. And when they started wearing the Scarlet M, it became a very effective deterrent. And
When you say detention barn, you mean 24 hours before?
24 hours before the race, they had to be in a detention barn that had 24-hour camera surveillance.
The horses, not the trainers.
The horses, not the trainer.
So this effectively put a stop to it, do you think?
Yes, it did. Once Jeff Mullins, the trainer you mentioned before, was publicly announced as being placed in the detention barn, we only had one additional trainer test over 37. We've had none test over 39, and for the last 9 weeks of the meet, we had none. So out of 5,670 horses we tested at Santa Anita, only five tested over 37, and the last one was in February.
And what sort of, other than the stricture on putting his horses in a detention barn 24 hours before the race, Mr. Mullins, who's, you have to say, sort of the poster boy for milkshaking, what other penalties did he receive?
He received none, and the problem with that, and a lot of people don't understand that, is that this is a contract between the horsemen, that is the trainers, the owners, and the racing association. As such, we can't suspend, we can't fine, we can't redistribute a purse, and we can't disqualify a horse. There is, in California, it's taking legislation that'll change that. The bill is should be heard this month. And when the horse racing board takes over, it will include any violations, will include fines, suspensions, purse redistributions, and disqualifications. But we don't have the power to do that. We're operating under a contract between the horsemen and the racing associations at this time. But even at that has been effective.
Okay, well, we've been talking about this problem of milkshakes, but that's sort of the drug du jour, the craze, if you will. I mean, there's a long, decades-long history of problems with other drugs as well.
Yes, there is. And horse racing, first of all, you should understand that horse racing has the strictest drug testing program of any professional sport. And some of that is drugs that you would be able to use at halftime in a NBA event, for example, are absolutely prohibited in horse racing. So there are a lot of medications. In fact, 80% of the drug positives are called in horse racing are residues of legitimate therapeutic drugs that for some reason have shown up in the test sample. That's not to say that they're not a problem, because some legitimate drugs can be drugs of abuse. For example, Dutro in New York just got suspended for mepivacaine, which is Novocaine for horses, if you will, mm-hmm. which is used very commonly. I just sutured up a wound on a horse this morning that I used mepivacaine on. And that horse is running in 7 days. I know that drug's not going to be in that horse's system. But if a horse has an injury that is blocked with a local anesthetic and run, that is not only abusive to the horse, it risks the jockey, and it's deceitful to the public. It's pure and simple abuse. What happened in the case in New York, I can't really say, but you should not have mepivacaine in the horse's system, and it is prohibited, but it's used commonly.
We're talking about drugs and horse racing. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's bring in Carol. Carol's calling from Hicksville in New York.
Hello.
Hi.
I've been a horse owner for, oh goodness, probably 30 years or more, and I have a lot of veterinarians that are very good friends of mine that I know as personal friends. I also used to date a trainer at Belmont Park quite a few years ago who is no longer training. But I have been intimately in and around these horses and veterinarians for a very long time. And I just want to say that until you really hold the veterinarians accountable as the last person who treated these horses, you're never going to really solve the problem, because I know everybody's always out there looking for the latest drug that is outside the spectrum of testing. And they have all of their contacts in the drug industry, et cetera. The drug industry feeds them what they think may work and is outside the spectrum of testing. And so until you really hold the veterinarians accountable, as, you know, the last person that treated this horse, actually, other than the trainer, you're never going to solve this problem.
Dr. Arthur, you're a veterinarian as well as the director of the Oak Tree Racing Association.
Well, I think she's partially right, and certainly the Racing Medication Testing Consortium, which is a national group that's looking at this problem, has specifically stated that any licensee, including the veterinarian, must be held accountable. Really, a problem in horse racing is what we have, the trainer-insurer rule, which basically says the trainer is responsible for everything. He certainly has control over the veterinarian, or control over the horse and the veterinarian. But what it has done, it is our regulatory agencies don't really get to the root of the problem. And I agree 100%, whoever the culpable individual is needs to be held accountable. Unfortunately, today, when I first started practicing, there was one barn for each stable. Now there's 8-10 veterinarians that operate in the barn independently, and regulating that's going to be difficult. But I agree 100% that whoever is involved needs to be held accountable, not just the trainer. If veterinarians at fault, they need to be held accountable.
Carol?
What if a veterinarian had to log in? You know, I treated a horse, and I had to log that in, so that I was logged in as the last veterinarian that treated that horse. Now if he comes up positive or something, I'm going to be the first person they're going to look back on to see who was the last one who signed in as a treatment. You know, and you would have to legally log in as who treated that horse.
That's already done in California.
Uh-huh. Not elsewhere, though?
I don't know how it's done elsewhere, but in California we've done that ever since I started practicing 30 years ago.
So what happens when you do get positive? It doesn't seem to go really back to the vet, though. I mean, not that I'm so involved in California racing that I really don't know, but it doesn't seem to me that it does immediately go back to the veterinarian, as accountable.
Well, you're absolutely right, and part of that again is because the regulatory agency has already assumed that the trainer is responsible, and oftentimes the veterinarian won't even be called in on a positive. If I have a trainer that has a positive for a drug, particularly something that I administered, which fortunately in my practice happens very, very rarely, I volunteer to go in, and usually we have an explanation of why that has occurred. And again, most positives are residues of legitimate therapeutic drugs that have shown up for some reason, whether the horse has run too quickly or the laboratory changed the testing procedures, and usually they're at levels well below any pharmacological activity. The problem in horse racing, many of the rules have been written back in the 40s, it says no foreign substance. Now we have, we're detecting drugs at the nanogram, picogram levels in terms of the clenbuterol, for example.
Carol, so, I'm afraid we're going to have to stop it there because we're running out of time. But, Carol, thank you very much for the call. Very interesting. And, Dr. Arthur, thank you for your time today.
Good luck. Thank you.
Dr. Rick Arthur, director of the Oak Tree Racing Association. We'll be back with more on this after a break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about efforts to control performance-enhancing drugs in horse racing, juiced thoroughbreds and steeds on steroids, what the industry worries about on the eve of the Derby. Of course, you're invited to join the conversation if you follow horse racing. Are you concerned about drugs in the sport? What should be done? Our number is 800-989-8255, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Andy Beyer, horse racing columnist for The Washington Post. He's with us from his home here in Washington, D.C. He's also the creator of the Beyer Speed Figures, which appear in the Daily Racing Form. Andy, always nice to talk to you.
Hi, Neil.
Going back to something Dr. Arthur said in the previous segment, years and years ago, he said, when these laws were first written up, he said, no foreign substances. Over the decades, over the years, one by one, state racing associations allowed some drugs to be used more and more in racing. How come?
There was an argument made by horsemen starting in the early 1970s that because of the stress and the wear and tear on horses from year-round racing, that horses needed a little extra help, to get through to survive the rigors of the modern game. They didn't get turned out on farms in the winter like they used to, and so that was the impetus for the legalization of butazolidine, the painkiller. And then there was an argument that the stress of modern racing, causes horses to bleed in their lungs. So that was the legalization of Lasix, and on and on, so that the what is legal has gotten more and more wide open. I mean, in Kentucky, they allow painkillers that in humans are the kind of things you would, you would be administered after undergoing an operation for cancer or whatever. I mean, it's not just sort of, this is not like taking a Motrin. So we've seen a great change in the attitude toward legal drugs. And that has also been accompanied by an explosion of illegal ones.
Because many of the legal substances can mask the presence of illegal drugs, and then you get into this sort of arms race, this hopscotch of there's a new drug, and then you find a way to detect it, and there's another new drug, and it goes on and on and on.
Yeah, I mean, the chemists say that with all the legal drugs that are in a horse's system, particularly Lasix, which is said to be a masking agent, to go into a blood or urine test and find a milligram or a microgram of some illegal substances, like looking for a needle in a haystack.
Now, we heard about the effort in California to try to solve this problem of milkshakes that we were talking about. You've described that as an important step in the right direction. Kentucky's also moving for reform.
Well, there are some steps are being made, but I'm pretty pessimistic and frankly pretty depressed about the current state of the game. I mean, I think that the use of illegal drugs is so widespread and so out of control that these are not assorted brush fires that have to be put out. This is like a raging forest fire.
And when Dr. Arthur was talking about the structural inability to deal with these questions in the state of California, you've got different kinds of organizations in all kinds of different states. There's no commissioner of horse racing to say this is now the rule.
Well, I think that there is even more significant than the structural failings. There's a real lack of will. I mean, all racetracks are very dependent on their trainers and particularly their big trainers, to put on the show. Horse racing has enough image problems to begin with that no racetrack wants a scandal making front page headlines. So that I think there is an instinct within the racing industry, not to stir the waters too much. You almost never see high profile cheaters get the book thrown at them.
Let's get another caller involved in the conversation. And Tom is with us. Tom calling from Chevy Chase, Maryland.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Mr. Bayer. This is my first time calling. I used to be a groom, and also I'm an attorney now. What a change of careers. But anyway, I've been around racing. My mother first brought me to track, and I'm just going to make two quick comments. One is that I think the last call was placing the burden with illegal use of drugs on horses. On the vet, I think she's just being unrealistic because you have so many people come in contact with the horse. Not only the vet, you have the trainers, you have the grooms, and you have other people. And my second comment, I agree with you when you say that there's a widespread use of drugs in terms of Lasix and Butte and for good purposes, and then you have drugs being used for bad purposes. But my point is, I think, the drug manufacturers themselves, it's big money. I mean, you got the company like BDX, I'm not promoting BDX stock or anything, but, who make equine medications, and it's big money. And as you're saying, I think you have to take and put some legislation in place in order to take and try to get some type of cure for the problem, because if you have lobbyists now, you have a lot of people you have to deal with, and I just think that with the horse racing industry, it's like any athletic associations, you're going to have problems. And, the quick fixes, I don't think is going to get the job done. I think.
Yeah, a lot of the drugs that make their way to the racetrack are ones that are legal for use on humans, and then vets and other unscrupulous types experiment with you know, to see if they're going to help horses. One of the latest that I hear whispered around the track is the venom from a snail found in the Great Barrier Reef that is supposed to be a tremendous painkiller.
You're kidding.
The quest will never cease for ways to find an edge.
But what about Tom's point about so many people having access to the horses? Could that system that's proposed in California of putting horses in solitary confinement for 24 hours before a race?
I'm certainly in favor of that. If the drugs in question need to be administered, within that amount of time. But a lot of people, have access to horses, but basically the way the system works is the trainers who want to cheat, find a vet or work with a vet, who has access to the right illegal drugs or knows the right cocktail, and they are the partners in crime. The notion that the drugs are a huge problem is not just wild paranoia. Anybody who follows racing today will observe that at tracks across the country, at almost every track, you will have a trainer or two who appears to have magical powers, who almost any time the trainer acquires a new horse and runs him back, that horse will improve dramatically. You have trainers today who are winning races at rates that defy all historical norms. I mean, I think one of the best trainers in America is Bill Mott, the man who trained Cigar a few years ago. And when he had Cigar, he had the most powerful stable in the country. He's a great horseman, and he won like 24% of his races during the year. Today, you get guys who you've never heard of training stables of moderate quality, and you see their winning percentages are 30%, 35%. It defies all logic to think that so many trainers are that suddenly that good.
Tom, thanks very much for the call. After talking about trainers, let's talk with one. Joining us now from his office in Lexington, Kentucky, is Remy Belloc, Executive Director of the National Horsemen's Benevolent and Protective Association. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Neil. I'm a big fan of the show.
Thank you.
All the time.
Your organization represents over 40,000 trainers and owners. What is their view of this problem? Is the last line the trainer?
Well, and I've been listening to my good friend Andy Beyer and, of course, Dr. Arthur, and, I think like any other issue, whether it be steroids in baseball or anything else, I don't think it's ever quite as bad or as good as, we may pretend it is. I understand Andy's pessimism, but I do think from our perspective that with the creation of that racing medication and testing consortium that Dr. Arthur referred to, we are absolutely, turning a corner, at least as far as analyzing the situation and understanding the issue. And I think what the issue is that if we are going to tackle the issue of racing medication, uniformity is the key. The problem we have today is that, and believe me when I say that, as far as our horsemen, my horsemen want to get rid of the bad apples as much as anybody else. And like in the other industry or sport, there's always a couple of folks that get all the press and attention and ruin things for the honest workers. And so we've issued a proposed national policy, which is on our website, and we've engaged in with the Racing Medication and Testing Consortium on some basic fundamental understandings. One of them being we need to have the same three-point line across the nation, and that's going to require California, which is much more restrictive than other states, to kind of adjust their regulatory practices and have other states that might be more liberal move up so that at least we're starting with an even playing field. That way the regulators, who, by the way, do stay on top of things. When Andy mentioned snail venom and all these things, they, mm-hmm. they're quite aware of what's going on, and we do need to put more money into batch stretch surveillance and things like that. But before we do anything...
Don't more teeth need to be put in this? We heard about Jeff Mullins, who's found guilty of the milkshake. Got nothing for that, though his horses were isolated for a while, 30 days, I think. And then he was subsequently found in violation of another medical violation for which he was fined $1,000. Boy, that sounds like a deterrent.
Absolutely. I mean, I agree 100%. More teeth, stiffer penalties, you know, putting folks out of the industry. But one of the problems is you're only as strong as your weakest link. And like I said, if a positive for a therapeutic medication, let's say butazolidine, which is an aspirin used basically for horses for training purposes, if a certain level of butazolidine is a positive finding in California because they have a much more high zero tolerance level of testing, then in another state where it's the level is maybe more liberal, but certainly it won't affect the outcome of the race,
mm-hmm.
then you know that difference creates havoc because, you know, then the trainer that may race in both states, because remember, trainers are racing, you know, in one state and another. On Saturday, trainers will be coming from everywhere. You know, they may get a positive report innocently because they just didn't quite understand that state's regulatory level. So before we do anything to put, you know, stiffer penalties, we've got to come up with a national level of therapeutic levels for therapeutic medication, thresholds we call those.
May I jump in here?
You can. Andy, let me just pause to say that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Andy, go ahead.
What Remy describes as, you know, therapeutic medications like aspirin are in fact drugs that are illegal almost everywhere else in the racing world. I mean, in other jurisdictions, Lasix, clenbuterol, and other things that are taken for granted here would get you a long suspension. So having already fought to legalize things that are verboten and in most of horse racing, you know, then the horsemen take the attitude, well, if you've it's legal, and if you've got too much clenbuterol or too much bute, well, that's just a tiny little technicality. I mean, the fact is that even what we consider permissible kind of goes against the grain of horse racing throughout most of its history.
I think what's important to understand is that the direction, for, as far as the specifics, you know, there's recommendations by the RMTC, Neil, that will say basically that you can't administer any therapeutic medications, certainly not any class 1 medications, which don't belong anywhere near a horse, but there's going to be a 24-hour rule before race day. The other thing, too, that's important to understand is that I agree with Andy. I think that, you know, we need to stiffen the penalties, make them more uniform. But
is anybody considering, it was not all that long ago, that any drug was illegal in New York State? Obviously a very big racing state. They changed their rules for various reasons. But why don't you go back to that standard? It's pretty easy to pick up violators if the standard is nothing.
And again, this goes back to my point. Having spent time on horses' backs and on the backstretch, which I've experienced quite a bit of racing from all facets. But I think, so long as Andy mentioned before, that we have an industry that requires a lot of racing, a lot of racing dates. We have to be, reasonable in that. You know, let's come up with a policy that rewards the honest trainers, the hard workers, and penalizes the bad guys. And I don't think going back to no racing medication policy will do that. Now, Andy refers to other jurisdictions.
And I have to ask you to wrap it up in about 30 seconds.
Well, basically, you know, in other parts of the world, they race a lot less than they do in the States. So we require therapeutic medications, just the same as if you or I went jogging and and got a little sore, we need to take some aspirin or what have you. I think we need to have a reasonable policy that helps the honest trainers and penalizes the bad guys. And
I can hear Andy Beyer fuming about the aspirin comparison, but I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Remy Belloc, thanks very much for calling, being with us. Remy Belloc, Executive Director of the National Horsemen's Benevolent and Protective Association, with us from his office in Lexington, Kentucky. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Andy Beyer, as always, good to have you on the program.
I always enjoy it, Neil. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Andy Beyer, horse racing columnist for the Washington Post, creator of the Beyer speed figures that you'll see in your daily racing form. We'll be back after the break to talk with Ayaan Hirsi Ali, most controversial politician in the Netherlands. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.